You're all set, sir.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks for asking me to share. My name is Dave Nelson. I'm an alcoholic. Happy to be here with you guys. I'm a member of the How It Works group, which I believe is the parent of this group. We were a big book table at How It Works Saturday morning, and when COVID hit, you guys started this thing, and Mark Fisher and a bunch of y'all, and I'm very grateful for that because during COVID, this was the only game in town for me, at least. I was here most every morning for the first couple of years, and kept me sober. And AA has kept me sober, so I'm very grateful for that. My sobriety date is August 10, 1988, and I am, as my sponsor likes to say, a satisfied customer of Alcoholics Anonymous. Jim was talking about service, and I have to tell you, I would divide my AA tenure in two periods. The first period was not really service oriented. For I'd say the first 20 years or so, I was a member of a home group. I've always been a member of a home group, and I usually tried to pull my own weight in that group. But the home groups I was involved in didn't seem to generate any service opportunities. The only thing I did during my first 20 years was we did take a commitment to a correctional facility one month out of the year. This was out of I was a member of the Hillbilly group back in Orchard Park at that time, and so every July, a bunch of us would go out to the Erie County Correctional Facility in Alden and run a meeting out there, and I liked doing that. And I always felt good when I did it, but it was that was pretty much the extent of it. My group did not participate in the service structure. We didn't have a GSR. We didn't hear reports about what was going on in New York City, and I think I wish I had been. That's all I can say about that. I think my experience has been greater now that I've started to get involved more in service, which I would date back to, the late 2010s, like 2009. And I started getting involved in participating in the groups, and my experience has been the richer for that. So anyway, I should qualify a little bit. I grew up with two brothers and a sister. My parents were together, loving family. The one thing I do recall about that experience was that they were drinkers, and so there was a cocktail hour in our house, and the adults got to, after work hours, share a cocktail. And there was responsible drinking. It wasn't drunkenness or craziness, but I always associated drinking with being adult and being sophisticated, and I aspired to that. So as soon as I could get away with it, I would have my own cocktail hour, but wasn't quite as sophisticated. I started drinking in high school, and mostly just weekends. And but early on, I had blackouts from the very, very first drinking experiences, and I thought that was cool. I liked being told what I had done, having no recollection of it by my friends when I was out drinking. And I thought that was it made me, I don't know, I liked the idea of that. And alcohol did work on me to the sense that it changes my personality. By nature, quiet, reserved, kind of shy. But you put a few drinks in me, and I'm, a totally different person. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is not an exaggeration. And I would tend to go off on, I'm a bit of a drama queen. So when I got really loaded, I would do crazy shit, and get myself into real jams. So to give you a couple examples, my graduation night from high school. I thought the best thing that I could do to celebrate that would be to get 2 6-packs of beer, go sit in my own car or my father's car, and drink them, and then go to a party outside of town. And I was at this party, and I got into a fight. And driving home, I turned the wrong way. Instead of going right, I went left, and ended up cracking the car up, going off the road. And you know, and so the only thing I could think of doing was to run away. So I ran away to a nearby town where I had friends, and sobered up, and I had to admit what I had done and come back and explain things. And so that's one example. A couple years later, I was going off to college, a junior year in France. And the night before we left, I had 5 guys in a car, and we were drinking at a bar outside of town. Coming back into town, too fast, took a corner and took the car into a railroad underpass and smashed it up. And fortunately, you know, nobody was seriously injured, but I could have killed everybody. You know, it's just that kind of thing. And I thought that was just luck of the draw. You know, I didn't feel remorse. I felt sorry for myself, I guess, but it never really dawned on me the seriousness of what I had done. So there I am over in France now, my junior year, and I'm the guy in the bus drinking wine, and making a lot of noise and just going nuts. You know, I was, that's really, before I went to France, before my junior year in college, I was a weekend warrior. But you know, in France, they drink every day. They have, you know, you go through the lunch line at school, and they have little pint bottles of red wine. And so I loved that. You know, I'm a daily drinker from that day on. And you know, there are a lot of drunken episodes in France, but I had a good time. I got to admit, I enjoyed myself. But I just never really looked at my drinking as a problem, but it was. And I went away. You know, when I came back to my senior year in college, I barely graduated because I couldn't complete the science requirement. I remember that I really had to beg to the professor to give me a passing grade so I could get a diploma. What I was good at was drinking. You know, and I remember days when we lived in a residential building, a converted frat house, and they had a jukebox in the basement and a refrigerator where your beer was on the honor system. So you make a check mark when you took a beer out of the fridge. And I would, lying in the basement of this, waking up, you know, drunk and hungover, and walking upstairs to Sunday morning breakfast, and people are all nice, dressed up, you know. And here I am, like a smelly, drunken mess. And I was proud of that. I would consider myself a hard drinker, you know, and I was proud of that. And it never occurred to me that there was a problem with that. So then after college, I joined the Peace Corps, and I went to Morocco. And I recall going to the plane over. I was drunk on the plane. If I had done what I did on today back in 1971, you know, they probably would have turned the plane around and arrested me. You know, I was just loud and just nuts. But they didn't. I got to my assignment, and I was teaching English in a high school in Morocco for a while. But I have the distinction of being someone who got a dishonorable discharge from the Peace Corps. You know, after 1 year, they said they didn't need me anymore. And the culmination of that was I was in a train station in Rabat after drinking all night long and just more or less causing a real disturbance, shouting and screaming and carrying on. And, you know, it made no sense at all, but that's what I did. And so once all the dust settled and they looked at all the facts, they said, you better go home. So I went home. And got home, and I kicked around for a while. I'm from Attica. I went to high school in Attica, and when I was in the Peace Corps, the year I was in the Peace Corps, 1971, was the year that the Attica riot went off. And so if you might can imagine, I'm sitting there in Tangier getting training, and Time magazine, the cover of Time magazine is my hometown, you know, and the Attica prison rebellion. So it was just so I got a job as a teacher in the Attica prison for a couple months. And this was a couple years after I got back, 73. And I didn't feel comfortable doing it. So I lasted 2 months and I said, you know, this is not for me. And I got to get out of here. So I went back to graduate school. Drinking continued. And I, there was a bit of a romantic disappointment culminating with some kind of a psychic breakdown. And I ended up walking into a classroom on the UB campus, 8 a.m. with a bottle of whiskey, deciding I'm going to take the French class. It wasn't my class. It was a co-worker's teaching assistant's class. So I'm going to take it hostage. So I barricade the doors. I tell all the foreign students, you guys can leave. This is just between me and the American students. So, you know, nuts, you know, really crazy stuff. And ended up in Meyer Hospital and in and out of hospitals for a couple of months, heavy psychotropics. I didn't have a clue what I was doing, but eventually I concluded that what I really wanted to do was to stay. Stay away from institutions. So my answer to that was to stay mellow. And for me to be mellow, I needed to drink 6 beers a day. That was my diet minimum. And so I felt if I would just keep 6 beers in me, I won't lose my temper. I'll stay mellow and I won't get tossed back in the booby hedge. So I did that for a long time. Kicked around a lot of different jobs. I was a substitute teacher. I drove a taxi cab. I worked in a boys' home. But after 6 or 7 years of kicking around, I said, you know, I'm not going anywhere. So I decided to go to law school. And by that time, I think I'd already had at least one, maybe two DWIs. But my freshman year, my first year of law school, I remember Christmas break. I was living in the city, driving back from Attica for a Christmas party, and I stopped for DWI. And I was lecturing the trooper that stopped me. He said, you know, I'm only a mile from my home on the west side. Don't you have anything better to do than to harass? You know, it didn't cut it. And I ended up in the clink and, you know, held overnight in the Delaware Avenue holding cell. And I remember like 4 or 5 a.m. they send around the bail people to try to determine, you know, who can be ROR'd. And so the person that comes to my cell door is a classmate of mine from law school, you know. And here I am drinking my weak tea and donut. And, oh, hi, Susie. How you doing? Good to see you. You know, like it was a everyday occurrence, you know. And I just, again, I never occurred to me that I had a problem, you know. It's just, I had bad luck, you know. So long story short, I graduated from law school. And once you get out of law school, you have to pass what they call a character and fitness test. And so I go through that process. And lo and behold, all my classmates, they go through, they sail through. This process, and the people I meet with says, well, we think you better come back in a couple of weeks. We want to look at this again. I had, you know, my arrest record, my hospitalization record. I had to disclose all that. And so I needed to get a psychiatric exam and get a clean bill of health. So I went to see a psychiatrist, and he wrote up a nice report, told the committee that I would be a safe bet, and they could safely admit me into the bar. But privately, he told me, you know, Mr. Nelson, based on what you've told me, I'm not going to put this in the report, but I think you should stop drinking. You know? And I gave that due consideration and immediately rejected that idea and went on my way, merry way. By this time, I married a woman in my third year of law school, and we were starting our life together, and I continued drinking. So I was married and practicing law for about 6 years before I hit my bottom. And I thought my marriage was a good marriage. I thought we were doing okay. The only arguments we ever really had was over my drinking, you know. And I recall incidents where my wife would call me on my drinking, and I would just blow up. Don't ever talk to me about that. How dare you? You know, I didn't want to hear about it. So we had three kids. In 1988, it was a hot summer. I had a three-year-old son and two 9-month-old twin boys. And I was out, had a day off in the middle of the week. There was a golf tournament, and got home dinner time, and my parents were visiting from Batavia. They were living in Batavia at the time, and I was pretty loaded. I was definitely loaded, and it made a mess of dinner. I think I spilled the wine on the table. I don't really recall them leaving, the parents, but they did. And then I don't recall much of anything after dinner. But it turns out I learned the next day that what happened was I passed out. I was laying on the living room floor in our house, and it was in August, and it was hot. And my wife had these three kids, little kids, that she had to get to try to get them to sleep. And so what she did was, and she often did that, was she would take them out in the car and drive around. And she told me that she would take them out singly, took them out to the car, put them in the car, and then drive around and bring her back in. And so I had this image in my mind from that story that she had to step over my body every time she took a kid out to the car, and then on the way back again. So that image was in my mind. I couldn't shake it. So I often wonder if I'd only managed to crawl up to stairs to bed that night instead of passing out on the floor. I don't know if I'd made it here, but I didn't. And so that image just stuck in my mind. And a couple of days later, it was a Saturday, I remember sitting at the kitchen table and having my first beer of the day, close to noon probably. And I asked my wife, she said, "Oh, Mary, you think maybe I have a drinking problem?" Because I couldn't shake that thing, and I knew I had to talk about it, or at least get some reassurance. And I was hoping she was going to tell me, "No, Dave, you're tired." You know, I was hoping she would enable me, but she didn't. She said, "Yeah, I think you do have a problem." So I didn't know what to do, and I thought I needed to do something. So I called the Bar Association. I always advertise for, if you have a drinking problem, call this number. So my idea was that they were going to hook me up with some sophisticated counseling, and I could get some psychiatric attention and get me back on the straight and narrow so I could drink like a gentleman. That was what I was hoping for. That's what I expected. But what happened was this person that I called, she said, "Well, you should call this guy. Call Jay. He's a lawyer downtown, and he'll talk to you." So I called Jay, and I went to his office, and he told me his story, you know, just like I'm telling you, just told me his story. He didn't really ask me a lot of questions, didn't want to know any details. He just told me what his experience was, what happened, and what he was like now. And he said, "If you think that anything I said is of any interest to you, or you can relate to it, here's a meeting schedule. I suggest you check out an AA meeting." So I took the schedule, took the meeting schedule home with me, and I went home. And I think I had night court that night, so I didn't do anything with it right away or that night. But other than I finished all the beer in the house, right, finished the whiskey in the bottle. But the next day, I went to my first meeting. It was a speaker meeting. There was two speakers, a man and a woman. The woman She didn't say anything that I was impressed by, but the guy told my story, and more or less. He wasn't a lawyer or anything, but he had similar experiences, and he drank like I did, and he made an impression on me. And so what also made an impression on my first meeting was just the welcome I received from AA, and the sincerity of the people. I just was just touched. And they said, keep coming back, and you don't have to live like that anymore. And it just what really impressed me, I don't know, it struck me at the time, was how the people, their eyes were so clear. The whites of their eyes were just, stunning. And I said, my eyes were always bloodshot. And I said, wow, they looked, this is a different outfit here. So I went to another meeting, and so I went to. They told me to, go to 90 meetings, 90 days, and go to the beginners tables, and say a prayer. Don't drink. Go to meetings, and I basically did that, for a long time. Joined a home group. They told me to get a sponsor, and I did get a sponsor. A guy, nice guy. I think he had about a year and a half sobriety, and so he did the best by me that he could, and he let, and I went through the steps with him to up to the fifth step. I did my did a four step. It was just a it was an autobiography. I didn't do it like the book big book says. It didn't. I just told my story and to myself, and then I told my story to this guy. I tried to be as honest as I could, but I really didn't go through the. Who did I hurt? Who did I resent? Who did I fear? None of that. Didn't do that. But I felt like, at the time, I guess it was the best four step I could do, or the best fifth step I could do at the time, and it kept me moving. So I went through it. Went through the 12 steps, as best I could, and I stayed sober. Right, and I had a. Like I said, I was made coffee for my home group and did my little commitments that I mentioned earlier, and I was my life changed. I definitely was a happier camper than I was before. The person that I was, here's the way I was when I was drinking. All I really wanted to do was drink. What I want, there was a rocking chair in my living room, and there was a sideboard, and we had put our liquor bottles there, and I wanted a beer and a shot glass and a whiskey bottle, and I wanted to be left alone and in peace. And anything that came between me and that scenario was just a annoyance, and interfered with my enjoyment, what I felt I needed, what I wanted. So kids, wife, job, none of that meant anything to me. All I really wanted to do was drink. And I was amazed when I was able to put the drink down and not pick it up again. I was amazed. I had 2 days in a row. I hadn't had a day in a row without a drink before that, for 20 years practically. And then a week, and then a month. And then one thing that impressed me about going to these meetings, and I did try to go to mostly beginners meetings at the start, was the repetition of the same story. Many, many repetitions of the same story from different individuals. And basically the story was, I'm coming back for my second, my third, whatever. I was got sober in AA. Things were getting better. I got my job back, my girl back. And then I started cutting back on meetings, and then I stopped going to meetings, and then I picked up another jackpot. I heard that story over and over again. And it just really impressed me that, well, if I don't want to do that, so I'll just stay involved, stay in touch. And I did. And here I am, so like I mentioned earlier, I thought I had a good marriage, and everybody has problems with their marriage, but I had a good marriage. But what I learned was, my wife told me many years later that she was thinking about divorcing me. I had no clue, and So kept the marriage together. I was able to participate in my children's growing up. They're in their 30s now. They're all independent, successful, have their own careers, and I have three grandkids. And I'm very fortunate that I have that, because I could have lost it all. I'm still a lawyer. I haven't had my license revoked or jeopardized at any time. Certainly, I could have easily lost that. I could have lost it all, but I did because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of this program. So, as I mentioned at the start, my program did improve, I think. It probably when it coincided with my wife's passing. She got cancer and we treated it for a couple of years. She died in 2009. She was 57. We'd been married 27 years. And the kids were growing, and it freed up. I missed her terribly. I was saddened by her death, but it freed up my time. So I started doing things in AA, which I would probably not do when she was alive because, had things to do as a couple. But so I started going to meetings. I joined this group of lawyers, international lawyers, Alcoholics Anonymous, and went to their conventions. And I joined, we did this. Some of you are familiar with the Step Action Group. I went through that, got a new sponsor, we went through, did the steps. And, I did the steps the way the big book tells us to do them. And I think I did it better, and I think my sobriety has been improved. And I did increase my service activity. And so I, at one point, moved into the city. So I joined my current home group, How It Works, and volunteered to be the GSR for How It Works after a couple of years of getting to know everybody. And so I went to my first GSA meeting, the General Assembly, and they do the committee reports. And they walk around and they go around, different committees have to report what's going on. And so they call for the corrections report. And the response was, well, there is no corrections report because we don't have a corrections chairman. And I kind of thought that sucked. So I volunteered to become the corrections chairman at that time, which I did that job for a couple of years and got more involved in trying to work through the area, get people involved in going to corrections. And I've kept that connection. I mean, I don't have that job anymore. In fact, I took a job as a GSR for How It Works again. I just started again this year, and I'm glad for that opportunity. But I still have a hand in corrections, and I go to a meeting out in Attica every Wednesday night. There's two of us. There's two guys, me and another guy, that run a meeting at Wyoming Correctional, which is a medium security right next to the Attica Max. And I've been doing that for quite a while. But the guy I'm doing it with is from Warsaw, and he's got like 38 years maybe. And he has been going to that prison for 35 years. He used to go on Wednesday, Saturday night for 35 years. He took a meeting in. Boy, that's talking about your commitment. But anyway, it's a very rewarding experience to do, to take the meeting into a prison. And I've never had a bad experience doing that. I've always felt welcomed and appreciated, and great, a lot of gratitude expressed by the prisoners that go to this meeting. And it's just if you haven't tried it, and I certainly would encourage you to look into that because it's a wonderful way to do service. So I talked a little bit about what it's like now. I'm not, I try, I do, I'm, I try to incorporate the steps into my life more than I did before. in the traditions. And right now I'm reading through the service manual and trying to get familiar with our concepts as well as everything else, because it's a the longer I'm around, the more I'm convinced that Alcoholics Anonymous is just a wonderful thing, and I'm just so grateful to be part of it. So the guy I was in 1988 is not the guy that's talking to you right now. You know, I was very self-involved, self-pitying. You know, and I didn't have anything to be self-pitying about. You know, so to give you an example of how sick I was, when I would go to bed, the one way I would get myself to go to sleep would be to dream up scenarios in my mind, you know, daydreaming, you know, oh, terrible things could happen to me and people would feel sorry for me, you know. I don't dream like, I don't have those daydreams anymore. You know? I don't need to generate castles in the sky or whatever. It's just, I'm dealing with the real world today. Sometimes it's not a pretty world, but it's real, you know. And I don't have delusions or illusions, and I don't have. And I want to be able to participate in life, and I'm happy to give back and share. And you know, this is obviously not one of my best talents. You know, I don't like speaking, although I am talking about my favorite subject, I don't do it very well. I'm always impressed by the speakers you guys get here, and I listen to tapes of the Serenity Improvement Group, and it's just, you know, AA is just a wonderful wonderful organization. I'm really proud to be part of it. You know, I'm running out of steam. I think I don't like to talk too much. I remember one time I was listening to a tape of Bill W's talk the day that Dr. Bob died. You know, and he was scheduled to give a lead, and Dr. You heard the news that Dr. Bob died, and he went ahead and gave the lead, and he was telling the story about him and Bob going to see, you know, AA number three, and the way Bill says it in his lead is, I told my story, Bob told his story, it took about an hour, you know. So I use that as my benchmark for how long I should probably give an AA talk. I don't think I should be entitled to talk longer than Bill or Bob did when they told their stories to this guy. So I'm going to shut up. Thanks for listening to me. Thanks for letting me share. And it's good to be with you all. Love you all.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate that very, very much. On behalf of everyone, we really, really appreciate your share. My name is Jim Carlo. I'm an alcoholic. A couple of comments I have on Dave's share that meant a lot to me, and then I'll open the floor. If anyone's having trouble thinking about picking up a drink, you're certainly welcome to share, or you're welcome to reflect on what Dave has shared. We've still got 15 minutes left, but